morning. I'm Chief Judge Castle. To my right is Judge Scholin. To my left is Judge Greenberg. We're here at Harvard Law School in the matter of Wilson J. Osmer, docket number 13-0085. Would counsel for the parties please note your appearance for the record?
Your Honor, from the Harvard Law School Legal Services Center, I'm Bradley Hinterwood. Along with me from the Legal Services Center is Daniel Nagin and Christopher Melendez, who will be doing our rebuttal this morning. Also with me is Zachary Stoles from Chisholm, Chisholm & Kilpatrick.
I see he's sitting at the table.
And Your Honor, Richard Daly for the Secretary, accompanied by Michael Carr, Deputy Assistant General Counsel.
Thank you very much. Are both parties ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor. We are.
Each party will have 30 minutes to present argument. Counsel for the appellant, do you wish to reserve a portion of your time for rebuttal?
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to reserve 10 minutes.
You have it. You may proceed. Actually, before you proceed, there are basically three major issues as we see it. One is the Servicemen's Civil Relief Act.
Yes, Your Honor.
One is the equitable tolling, and then you threw in a due process argument at the end. We'll try and keep our questions grouped in those areas, but you also may get questions from a different area later on. And I'd like to start, because we read everything that you've written already, I'd like to start with your equitable tolling argument. You generally put it in extraordinary circumstances, and yet there's a decision from the Federal Circuit called Barrett. You do cite it once, but you don't state that the doctor's statement that you submitted rises to the level of the high standard established in Barrett. And I'm wondering, your opposing counsel pointed out factors in the statement that indicated your client was driving, he actually was looking at some mail, and then eventually got to this particular letter from DAV and then proceeded to file his appeal. Did you purposely avoid stating that it met the Barrett standard because you don't believe it does, and then therefore put it into this extraordinary circumstances argument?
No, Your Honor. So Colonel, when we initially filed our brief with the court, we did not have these expert psychological opinion at that time. We only received that opinion prior to answering the questions that the court had asked for additional briefing on. At that time, it became clear, as the VA's brief points out, that there is uncontested medical evidence in the record that demonstrates that Colonel Osmer meets the Barrett standard. Consequently, we do believe that Colonel Osmer satisfies that standard as well as the McCreary standard for equitable tolling.
And did your client receive any medical treatment? Because this, as I understand it, was a consultant that was hired by you to have a phone call with the with your client. Did he actually receive any treatment during this period?
No, Your Honor. In fact, I believe Dr. Mangold's statement, his statement of his discussion with Colonel Osmer indicates that Colonel Osmer was very reluctant, as is frequently the case, as the expert witness indicates, to seek additional treatment. However, he was disability rated at 30% for PTSD prior to his deployment to Afghanistan. Also in the record is the original pension and disability assessment from 2007.
That was interesting. I didn't see any discussion by the doctor with the fact that your client was 30% rated for PTSD and yet served as a lieutenant colonel in combat situation. He came back and didn't receive any treatment. He was driving a car during this period. He was opening some mail. He looked like he, according to counsel, citing some statements that indicated he was purposely avoiding doing things because he'd been received some advice to do that. And yet, at the end, the doctor seems to say that he was impeded entirely, prevented from filing. Seems inconsistent with the actual facts of the statement.
Well, Your Honor, I'm not a psychologist. And I don't feel that I'm qualified to make those sorts of judgments. Veterans readjust in different
ways. Are we
ways.
Bound by the doctor's statement?
Your Honor, this Court is free to weigh the statements and all the evidence in the record. However, it's worth reiterating that the expert witness statement in this case from Dr. Mangold is the only medical evidence in the record outside of the 2007 original evaluation. It's the only evidence that speaks to the period at issue. So in those circumstances, it seems that if the Court grants weight at all to Dr. Mangold's expert medical assessment, then Colonel Osmer meets the Barrett standard.
Does this court apply the treating physician rule, thus giving more weight to treating doctors as opposed to an examining doctor such as this?
Your Honor, I'm not sure I follow your question.
There's certain courts and certain bodies of law that have a presumption in favor of the treating physician, that because they know the patient in theory best, they give more weight to that statement. And there are other courts that have rejected that and provide the same amount of weight, you know, based on the content of the examination. And so I'm wondering if, in response to Judge Castle's question of whether this doctor has actually examined the veteran or treated him or whether there was any treatment, we should ascribe more or less weight to this doctor's statement than we should otherwise.
My understanding is that this court does not apply, that it does not give any difference in weight. But in any circumstance, Dr. Mangold's statement is the only medical evidence on which to rely in this period. And even if less weight were to be granted to his opinion based on the fact that he's not a treating psychologist in this case, it's still the only evidence that we have of Colonel Osmer's capacity to file his notice of appeal in the months after his return from Afghanistan. Your Honors, I'd like to go back and start discussing the due process and ineffective mailing argument in this case. As we've noted, we believe there are two ways in which VA has failed to provide Colonel Osmer with effective notice of his appeal rights in this case. As VA does not contest, they were aware that Colonel Osmer was deployed to Afghanistan. He notified them on two separate occasions, once in May before his departure.
Didn't you include a statement from your client that was written from the war zone to the VA in response to another claim, indicating that he, one, received mail, and two, could respond to it?
Your Honor,
in October of 11?
Yes, Your Honor. That's the second time.
So if that went to the board and went to the VA, why wouldn't VA presume that they were sending it to the correct address, that he was receiving the mail and that he could respond to it?
Your Honor, the fact that they received this letter from Colonel Osmer in Afghanistan should have demonstrated that he was not at the Missouri address.
Well, the letter you submitted didn't have the envelope or indicate a return address.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Is there a reason?
I don't know why that material was with VA. They may have.
You don't know if it had an Afghanistan address on it?
No, Your Honor. We do not know.
So however, at that point, the VA would have his home address, would know that he was receiving his mail, and could respond to it.
Your Honor,
how does that rise to a constitutional violation?
Your Honor, there are two points to make about this. One is that under Robinson v. Hanrahan, it's clear that that VA should have constructive notice of Colonel Osmer's address in Afghanistan. If you recall, in Robinson, there's a prisoner who is held by the state. The state mailed a forfeiture notice to his home address, knowing that he could not get there and that he was not there. And the Supreme Court, in a per curiam decision.
But how does that fit if VA knows that he was getting mail? I mean, the facts that you presented to us, if you're reading it, anyone reading it would say, hey, this guy's getting his mail.
Your Honor, I believe his letter indicates that he received the mail only because his wife was able to communicate that information to him at that time in October when he mailed his letter to VA.
Where should VA have mailed the board decision to if it wasn't his home address?
VA has several options in this case for providing Colonel Osmer with effective notice. They could have mailed the decision to Afghanistan. They could have taken additional steps to ascertain his actual address.
Did he provide an Afghanistan address?
We don't know, Your Honor, but again, we believe that there's constructive knowledge on the part of VA of his Afghanistan address because he's in the custody and control of the government when he's serving abroad. In addition, VA was required to take additional steps in this case to try and ascertain his Afghanistan address, whether through the Department of Defense Manpower database or other sources.
I'm still having a hard time trying to figure out how a spouse who has a power of attorney and has indicated that she is forwarding the mail and that the soldiers responding from Afghanistan, why VA would have a constitutional duty to now figure out where he was in Afghanistan and forward it directly to him.
Your Honor, well, the statute that VA works under, 7104E, requires notice to both an appellant and any counsel or representative he might have. So in this situation, they have a duty to make sure that Colonel Osmer himself receives notice. In addition, the power of attorney that Colonel Osmer's wife had did not require her to take any additional steps. And in fact, with regards to his appellate rights due to the BVA decision, there's no evidence in the record that Colonel Osmer was aware of those rights. She did not inform him of those rights. And it would be unfair to hold
Wouldn't those be statutory violations if you were going to make an argument? Why do you try and elevate it to a constitutional due process argument?
Your Honor, we believe that VA has also failed to meet its statutory burden in this case. did not mail to appellant's last known address because of both the constructive knowledge argument and the fact that even a cursory examination of their files would have revealed that 2 weeks prior to the BVA decision, they received a letter from Colonel Osmer in Afghanistan. So under both, given both those points, we believe they did not fulfill their statutory responsibility to provide Colonel Osmer with effective notice at his last known address.
Don't you think you're much better off if you skip ahead to equitable tolling? And why shouldn't we just ignore all of this and believe the colonel?
If the SCRA applies, the time is tolled. Where does it, you know, he got notice when he got back.
That's correct, Your Honor. He received actual notice when he opened his mail in late December. And that at that point, he received actual notice.
So what happened to the board decision?
The board decision at his house, Your Honor? It was placed into the pile of mail that he received over 13 months during his deployment. And he was, as the expert witness statement indicates, unable to go through that mail until sometime in late December, at which point he promptly filed an appeal.
I thought I opened up a DAV letter, not the board decision. In fact, there's no mention of the board decision in any of your briefing other than the fact that the wife received it and mentioned it to him on the phone.
That's correct, Your Honor. So the initial...
What happened to the board decision? I mean, he opens up a letter from DAV saying you have a right to appeal, and all of a sudden he's out of his PTSD and he proceeds with his appeal. But what happened to the board decision that whole time?
I'm not sure, Your Honor. I assume it was in the pile of mail along with everything else. In any event, this Court has made clear that a veteran does not need to have his actual appeal BVA decision papers in order to file a notice of appeal with this Court. So the fact that he, as you point out, may not have actually ever physically received the BVA decision or may have received it after.
Did you ever ask the spouse why she didn't forward it to him?
Your Honor, in her affidavit, she states that she was she didn't understand all the material in the packet. It was a considerable amount of
I understand, but the facts that you gave us, she forwarded a different claim to him. He responded to VA with it. And in this one, there's no indication that you asked him that question as to whether or not why you didn't forward it. I mean, we know it's a thick packet. We know she didn't understand it. But you didn't ask or didn't put in there what she did with it.
That's correct, Your Honor. There's no discussion in the record of that point. But it was there was a, as they've noted, a phone discussion where they briefly talked about it. Colonel Osmer was able to ascertain that one claim had been granted and one had been denied. But he was not able, he was not informed of his appellate rights. His wife indicates that she didn't understand or read the entire packet. And in any case, they're talking to each other from Missouri and Afghanistan. There's quite a time difference. It's quite rare.
Did you ask why the other claim got forwarded to him? Is that the only mail that got forwarded to him, the other claim that he responded to?
There's nothing in the record to indicate how much mail he received when he was in Afghanistan. But we have a statement, you know, in his letter where he simply says that he did receive this letter that his wife forwarded.
Well, what if we believe the colonel? He's deployed once, 30% disability, deployed again, told a report, reports, does his duty. There's no controverted facts here as to what he says. Why shouldn't we just believe him and equitably toll the time?
We believe you should, Your Honor, in the event that you believe that the notice in this case was effective. Now, the Service Member Civil Relief Act, as this Court has brought up at the beginning, we believe applies to toll from the period at which he received his BVA decision until his separation from service.
The extra 172 days, why doesn't somebody have to say, shouldn't that be persuasive? Why shouldn't we accept it? It's not controverted by anybody else. The government doesn't say through witnesses or competent evidence, he's not telling the truth, he wasn't deployed. I mean, what are the facts that should lead us away from believing the veteran?
Your Honor, we don't believe there are any facts in this case, especially given the fact that the only medical evidence is uncontroverted medical evidence that Colonel Osmer meets both of the standards this Court has recognized for equitable tolling.
Well, forget them for a moment, if I may. The medical evidence, what evidence is controverted that's relevant to the question of equitable tolling? Remember where it comes from. Justice Alito in Henderson says the 120-day statute, which has command language, shall, doesn't quite mean shall, but leaves it to our court to decide on a case-by-case basis whether or not we should apply equitable principles to account for his failure to comply with the 120-day time requirement. Why not accept his testimony, uncontroverted, as to what he did, why he did it, why he failed to do certain things?
That's
correct. What's wrong with that?
Yes, Your Honor. This Court is completely free to toll simply on the facts of a given case. Equitable tolling does not have to fit into any given pre-existing category, as this Court has recognized. The Court is free to toll simply on the facts of the case, independent of the medical evidence, and free to simply accept Colonel Osmer at his word and toll on those facts.
Do you believe that the consistent with the entire construct of congressional intent with regard to veterans, that the benefit of the doubt, if there is any doubt, should weigh in favor of the veteran?
Yes, Your Honor. We believe that that rule of interpretation is entirely appropriate in a case like this. I'd like to turn briefly to the McCreary standard. We've discussed the Barrett standard.
I'd actually like to switch gears first.
Yes,
sticking with the SCRA, you also make an argument that the court could stay the finality of the board decision under, I believe it's Section 524. Some of the problems I'm having with that idea I'd like to explore with you, which are, why would the place to stay the finality of the board decision be the court, not the board? Or would we be finding error in the board not having stayed it?
Ms. Sharner, we briefed that question in response to the court's order. It was not part of our initial argument about the SCRA. We believe that there is a way to read those provisions in such a way that they apply to this case, 524 and 525, consistent with the Supreme Court's belief that the statute ought to be read liberally in favor of veterans. I don't believe you'd be finding error in the lower court, but it would simply be a liberal interpretation in light of the changing circumstances of veterans' law and changing circumstances of deployments, multiple deployments while disabled that veterans are facing. However, we believe the more natural application of SCRA to this case is Section 526, followed by equitable tolling. Your Honor, I'd like to, if there are no additional questions.
I'd like to go back to 524.
Sure.
In 524, you'd have to have a showing or finding by the court of material effect. And as I understand your argument, the material effect would be, one, that he went off to service, off to active duty. Two, he came back. And three, he had adjustment problems. And so you come to the court after the fact, and you ask us to, as I recall in your briefing, stay the finality of the board decision. I assume you'd like us to do it retroactively, non-protonque?
Yes, Your Honor.
Do you know the requirements to do that?
Your Honor, I believe that the court would be a new action in that
We've
case.
We've done non-protonque before.
Well, in not in the context of the SCRA, if I'm
no.
correct, Your Honor.
Well, what's the requirements to do a non-protonque decision?
I'm not sure, Your Honor.
Okay.
However, again,
so if we were to go ahead and do that non-protonque back to the finality of the board decision and add the 90 days that we can add under 525, then the 120 days would begin and the appeal would be timely.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes.
Your Honor. I'd like to pursue a hypothetical with you. Let's say a veteran, such as your client, but the board decision is issued the day after he comes home from being released from service. Is there any remedy available for him under the SCRA?
Meaning that the decision is rendered a day after he's released from service?
Yes.
No, Your Honor. In those circumstances, the appropriate remedy would be under equitable tolling, if such tolling is necessary.
Is there a different standard that applies for materially affected under 524 versus extraordinary circumstance or incapable of participating in your case?
Your Honor, yes, we believe that materially affected would be a lower standard in that situation. So perhaps there would be an opportunity, again, looking at the way that the Supreme Court in Boone versus Leitner suggested the SCRA is intended to be interpreted, to potentially provide a stay based on the circumstances in the case. However, again, the circumstances here require simply that 526 apply to toll till his separation. And at that point, we believe that the equitable tolling doctrine is the most natural way to...
But you have to reach the higher standard for equitable tolling.
That's correct, Your Honor. There would be a higher standard for equitable tolling, either under Barrett or McCreary. And as I see my time is running low, I'd like to turn briefly to the McCreary test. Colonel Osmer's claim is not merely a Barrett claim. The evidence in the case also demonstrates that Colonel Osmer satisfies the McCreary test.
I'd like to go back to it because I'm interested as an appellate court in its fact-finding role. A statement is submitted from a consulting doctor that has a veteran who is driving, reviewing mail, and by happenstance opens up a DAV-1 in December, and then immediately reacts to it, and then has a conclusory opinion at the bottom that says he's impeded from filing. And what is the level upon which this court, should we go and ask for a medical examination to be provided?
No, Your Honor.
This was a consulting-type doctor?
No, Your Honor. All the evidence that is necessary for this court to decide this case is before it today.
To reach that highest standard?
Yes, Your Honor. In this case, we have...
I mean, there was some questioning as to whether or not we should just accept the veteran's statement. Could the veteran just come in on an appellate court that's in its fact-finding role and say, hey, I had problems doing it?
He could try that, Your Honor. This court always engages in a fact-specific inquiry when it comes to equitable tolling claims and frequently, I believe, sees cases of that sort. However, here we don't have that issue. We have uncontested evidence that demonstrates that Colonel Osmer meets the Barrett standard.
Okay. Time is up.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Another specific question.
Thank you.
10 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honor, and may it please the Court. Once again, Richard Daly from the Secretary.
Why isn't your opposing counsel correct that it's the only evidence before this Court with regard to his client's capability to file an appeal?
He is correct that it is the only evidence speaking to the point. However, as Your Honor...
Did you attempt to have an examination done of the...
We did not. One was not sought, and even if one were to invoke the reasoning in what we'll call Barrett 4 and under 7252 analyze the propriety of seeking such an examination, first we would draw the distinction between the status of the state of the law then versus now. Then Henderson had not yet issued. So the question that the court was endeavoring to answer spoke to one of jurisdiction. Here there's no doubt that this court has jurisdiction. It's a question as to whether in its discretion it chooses to exercise that discretion or that jurisdiction and allow Mr. Osmer, the appellant, the benefit of equitable tolling.
Could we even have asked for could VA have sought an examination, as Judge Castle suggests, or would that be a Mariano developing to deny kind of situation?
Well, that's where the Secretary is forced to make a Hobson's choice. If, in fact, we secured an opinion that was adverse to the appellant's claim, well, then the most logical argument to be presented on appeal from that denial, presuming it denied, would be Mariano. The pressing fact here is just that it's a fact. It's appellant himself to date has not asked either the Secretary or this Court to order the Secretary to provide an opinion independent of Dr.
Because he thinks his opinion is sufficient.
I would characterize that, although I can't.
Well, why even speculate? What if he hadn't gotten a medical opinion? Why wouldn't the Secretary just on his own grant equitable tolling or not oppose this application? What's wrong with the colonel's uncontroverted testimony as to what happened, why he didn't make the time limit?
Well, Your Honor, as you framed it, it draws our attention to a rather salient and repeated and emphasized point that this Court has made in Bove, in Ratliff, in Rickett. The Secretary has no colloquial dog in this fight. We're simply here in response to your Court's order, our court's order, to get the Secretary's view of what the equities of this case actually warrant. This is a question for exclusively the court's discretion, and it's ultimately a question whose answer you must arrive
at. But at this point, it's not just totally discretionary. We do have case law, Bovee,
that is correct,
which re-implemented the equitable tolling requirements. So, I mean, the court could just say any veteran committed any time, we have a 120-day rule established by statute, and we don't care, we let anybody in. We could do that because it's a rule, and we can write rules. But we haven't done that. We have case law that has implemented the pre-existing equitable tolling requirements.
Yes, Your Honor. As your dialogue with Appellant's counsel reflected, Barrett, the Federal Circuit Barrett II, actually articulated a very stringent standard. You have to be incapable of rational thought or deliberate decision-making or unable to tend to your affairs or function in society.
Or participate in your appeal.
That, I suppose, would be correct in the absence of representation, yes. And in the extent that, that there is representation, that the infirmity was not so severe as to disrupt that relationship.
Well, why should, what's the Secretary's position on that issue? Should we maintain, as a court, that stringent standard? Or adopt a less stringent standard? Or abandon all of that?
Well,
and just decide it on a case-by-case basis based upon the facts presented to us?
It is somewhat of a fine point, Your Honor, because you have these rules that govern, but it is articulated as a case-by-case issue. But that case-by-case determination must necessarily be informed by what that stringent standard is. Given the conclusory nature of Dr. Mangold's opinion, which tracks the language of Barrett II, but appears to be unsupported by the facts it's narrated, appellant had sought reemployment as a college educator. He took a couple of vacations. He suffered some emotional disability. He had a slightly avoidant behavior. He expressed that his wife had informed him while he was deployed that the board had issued a decision and denied the relevant claim. And he thought that was final and didn't think he could appeal. Based upon all of these factors in the totality of the mosaic, the court quite plausibly could conclude that the reason for not undertaking the mail was not extreme, and in fact, the basis for not seeking out specifically the board's decision was not psychiatric symptomatology, but his ill-informed belief that it was an unappealable decision. Now, again, this is solely within the province of the court, and the Secretary is merely characterizing his view of what the evidence proffered to the court actually demonstrates.
Well, let me ask you a question that we haven't discussed then. The Board of Veterans' Appeals provides a notice of appellate rights with its decision.
That's correct.
The notice of appellate rights does not discuss the possibility of equitable tolling or knowing that this veteran was recalled to active duty, any information about the Soldiers and Service Member Civil Relief Act.
That's correct.
And how that applies. So if, as you assert, he had belief that he could not appeal it because he was gone longer than 120 days after his decision was rendered by the board, could we find the notice of appellate rights ineffectual in this context because the board knew he did not, he was not in country, at, or not in the U.S. at the time, and wouldn't have received the board decision?
No, Your Honor, respectfully. The appellate rights attached to board's decisions pro forma have repeatedly, and forgive me for being unable to cite a specific case, but nevertheless been endorsed as adequate.
But that was not in this context of a...
In the context of all the soldiers that we now have in reserves being called up to active duty. Why shouldn't you add it?
Well,
why shouldn't we direct that you add it?
Well, that would be somewhat of a slippery slope, Your Honor, insofar as if you want to tailor the requirements.
Well, the Servicemen Civil Relief Act, if I'm not mistaken, requires the secretary of the departments, the military departments, to provide notice with regard to it.
Well,
so there's no statutory requirement on the secretary of VA, but couldn't we impose it?
Arguably, yes, if the court were to issue an order.
So why would that be a slippery slope? If Congress has already said to secretaries of the military departments, you have to provide this information and knowledge, why couldn't we graft judicially on the notice to make sure it's complete, the fact that reservists called up to active duty, or anybody in active duty for that matter, I guess?
Well, the slope, as it were, would then be situationally to have to tailor broadly applicable.
Couldn't you just put if you are a reservist called up, National Guard called up,
Well, then, arguably, Your Honor, this court could then say that the appellate rights notification would necessarily require the Secretary to provide 7104D1 notice. We have to tell you that we have to tell you. How far down that slope one could take such a rule is really unforeseeable, but it nevertheless is, I think, somewhat of a red herring here because the Secretary has already conceded that Section 526 applies, and in fact, the period during which he was still deployed on active duty becomes a legal memory. It's irrelevant for purposes of...
Okay, let's talk about Section 526. I have some questions about how it could apply in sort of different world scenarios. Let's say Mr. Osmers had received his board decision 3 months prior to him being recalled to active duty. So he had 30 days of his 120 days left when he reports. So we could all agree that the 30 days would be told, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Is that what would happen when he got out, or should he get a new 120 days since the SCRA generally recognizes that we don't anticipate service members are going to jump right back into their everyday lives?
Right. Well, that would be another issue for the court to determine as it arises, and it would be perhaps not that dissimilar from motions for reconsideration under Rossner, where the entire 120-day period is renewed. The court could, in its wisdom, decide, no, he had 90 days prior to his service during which he could have filed his notice of appeal, and he did not. Therefore, we will not stop the clock.
Although in McCreary, we did say if something happens later in the appeal period, we're not going to penalize somebody for not acting sooner, and we'd be more likely to grant tolling.
Well, as Your Honor characterizes it, that is actually 100% correct. They said they might. That panel said they might take into account the occurrence of the event later in the period. But in Mr. McCreary's case, Hurricane Ivan took place very early during his appellate window. So that fact was never really a dispositive one in that case.
Or in the scenario that I presented, a stay would also be an applicable option.
Well, a stay, I think, is deceptively attractive, Your Honor, because, first of all, the whether it be 525, 522, or 524, the time at which a stay may be granted or requested includes all of the active duty service plus 90 days thereafter. Here, under any of the provisions, at no time during Mr. Osmer's status as a service member under 511 and the totality of the operation of the other sites I just offered, did he seek a stay. And while the board may have sua sponte issued a quote-unquote stay, which typically it doesn't do, it would just await the occurrence of a condition precedent before it would render its decision, much in the case as the Secretary sought to do in Rabaudo. But it nevertheless is immaterial because that would have been the body at which to seek such a stay, not this court. This court cannot reach back in time, and whether you call it time travel or nunk-pro-tunk, and convert Mr. Osmer back into a service member for purposes of the stay provision.
But we can stay any action. So does any action also include an appeal?
It would, except the rest of the language says any action or proceeding taking place before, during, or within the first 90 days after service. The court's proceedings do not satisfy those criteria. As such, the court, while it operating under its own rules, could stay these proceedings. It's unclear as to what to which that would avail the appellant, where it seems as though it might be bootstrapping to stay proceedings to make untimely commencement of those proceedings timely.
But isn't that what nunk-pro-tunk is? I mean, at the end of the day, we have a veteran. If you accept that he's in a combat zone, and while he could answer to one claim, for whatever reason, he couldn't answer to the other and didn't get much of his mail, he comes back, he files at a later time. And you construe all the filings here as a motion to stay the finality of the board decision, nunk-pro-tunk. And you go back to the date of the board decision, you add 90 days. What's wrong with that? What says you can't do that?
Because it's putting the colloquial cart before the horse. You can't exercise your jurisdiction over which something you don't yet have it. the board's decision prior to its rendering simply didn't exist, and under 7252 would be beyond this court's reach.
The decision's still out. We just say it's not final.
If your honors choose to pursue that form of relief or approach, well, then the secretary...
With regard to an appeal. Isn't that what we did in Rosser? With regard to an appeal in this court, the board decision was not final. With regard to an appeal in this instance, the board decision was deemed not final until 90 days after he got back.
Yes, Your Honor. That would be, I guess, somewhat analogous, but it's in a different context, I think, where you can't really... In Rosser, the court didn't stay the board's decision.
True, it baited finality.
Yes, I suppose in this case, the court could do it again, except in Rosner, the time frame within which the court could reach the board's decision was otherwise in a timely fashion.
No, I understand that, but that's exactly what non-pro-tunk is. I mean,
yes, Your Honor.
We actually did it back then.
If I could talk,
legal fiction.
If I could talk a little bit about what the board's obligations are not when somebody is deployed, you were saying that the board wouldn't probably just stay at wouldn't issue an official stay. They don't do that. They would just not act.
Well, it wouldn't be a stay, so to speak. And in fact, the case that I cited, the secretary did use the word stay, Ribaudo. But it wouldn't have been anything so formal on an idiosyncratic one-person issue. More likely than not, it would have been the board's judge recognizing in the record the appellant submission that he was deployed, saying, you know, let's correspond somehow with the appellant to the extent that we can. Contact him, had his record of address, and seen. Is Mr. Ausmer, in fact, accessible? Is he reachable? Is he able to engage in the development of the board's ultimate determination? But it was never anything that was required of the board. It could have, in the most, I guess, unique situation, undertaken those efforts, but it did not. It was not required to. And in fact, dealing with notice issues, somewhat akin to Appellant's Mullane argument, where he asked that the court invite or rather require the secretary to take extra statutory, extra constitutional steps to ensure that notice was actually provided. This court rejected
when
that.
When was the
land.
Statement of the case issued in this? Do you know?
I don't have that in my timeline at hand, Your Honor, but the board's decision was October 25th, court's indulgence.
Right, but I mean, if the statement of the case had been issued and the time had passed to
yes.
submit information, the board might be able to presume nothing's being submitted. But if that passed while he was called to active duty, it might be a reason why the board should have stayed because the time to develop the case had not passed.
Well, it may have been, Your Honor, but it was nevertheless not a required action by the board. The board, as Your Honor is well aware...
No, but we could find that it was an error by the board if, in fact, the time to respond passed while he was overseas. That could be stayed also.
Well...
And maybe was stayed by this act. Can your co-counsel look? Does he know? Does the record reflect it anywhere?
No, Your Honor. We don't have that with us.
Okay.
I suspect it's longer than that because of the delays in time between the filing of the Form 9 and the board actually taking jurisdiction of cases.
Right.
I'm sort of trying to pursue kind of like the policy idea of the secretary's approach to processing claims of called up service members. I understand that they generally try to proceed with them unless they can something is shown or some determination is made that the service member's presence is required to participate in the claim. Is that correct?
Generally speaking, as a practical matter, I believe that the Congress actually spoke to the policy question. It would not be for the secretary in any way.
I was looking at the general counsel's opinion that discusses how to implement such things. But
We don't actually need to reach that point, though, Your Honor? Because, again...
For my edification purposes.
Okay. Generally, the policy is to proceed lest we actually have this court's jurisdiction under the All Writs Act invoked. The last thing we want to do is unnecessarily delay something, and simply because someone is deployed on active duty does not per se mean that he or she wants the board to become inert on his or her appeal.
So let's say the VA regional office issues a decision while a service member is deployed, but it turns out the service member had additional evidence that they could have submitted, or perhaps the claim would have benefited from a medical exam that the person was not able to attend. Would that veteran have to appeal that decision, or would that decision be rescinded in some way under the SCRA?
More likely than not, once that veteran returned from service and found out that his decision had been issued, he would contact the regional office, and the regional office would, looking to 50 App USC 526, have said, oh, that one-year period limitation under the 7100 statute, 7104, I believe, doesn't begin to toll until the day that you returned home and got off of active duty. So more likely than not, would simply have either resubmitted the rating decision, or just begun to start counting again before requiring the NOD.
Well, I'm just concerned about a veteran having to be placed in appellate status within the agency, you know, requiring difference of opinion authority or whatever to reverse their decision, as opposed to it wasn't done enough, it wasn't cooked enough by the time we issued it.
Well, timeliness wouldn't be an issue because
not timeliness, just sort of the.
But the before we even get to this question, we must first have an adverse rating decision.
Right.
And regardless of where the appellant was at that time, he would have had to have put himself in appellate status. So there's no greater onus on somebody simply because of the timing at which the rating decision is issued.
How would they put themselves in appellate status if it's the first RO decision?
Because they would then see it and issue a notice of disagreement.
But why would they have to submit a notice of disagreement is my question. And I'm sort of just getting at if the RO decision shouldn't have been issued in the first place because the veteran's absence materially affected, we'll use these magic words, the proceedings such that the RO maybe shouldn't have issued the decision in the first place. Would the RO take back the decision, or would they make him appeal? That's all I'm asking.
Well, again, Your Honor, he would have to appeal regardless of whether he was on active duty. He would have had to have been dissatisfied with the outcome, and whether he was on active duty or sitting at home, he would have had to have challenged that decision at the
RO. I'm saying that decision might not have happened if he'd have been there, because he could have submitted new evidence. He could have whatever.
I understand, Your Honor.
Can I go back to a statement you made? I thought in one of the submissions, and I didn't find it when I was just flipping, but I thought in one of the submissions there was a reference, I think, to a FAST letter that was guidance to the regional office and board that you may proceed as long as it has been developed.
And here it was, Your Honor. There was nothing further that was needed to be developed.
But I mean, I guess what I'm getting at is one of the questions you were answering before. There is a duty on the adjudicator to make a determination that it was developed, and if they determine that it wasn't developed yet, they then wait until the soldier comes back. Is that correct?
That would be correct, and in fact, the way that the RO would know that they needed to wait was they would have been in contact, or they would have tried to be in contact with the veteran in question, and they would have discovered his deployment. That didn't happen here. At the board, there was nothing further that was required to be developed. Appellant simply was deployed on active duty and didn't get notice of his board's decision for purposes of the court's jurisdictional statute, the court's 120-day limit statute, until he returned home, which was in September of 2012. So 192 days lapsed, thus exhausting the 120 days under the court's statute, and then 72 days remaining.
What's the prejudice to the Secretary?
Well, it's not the Secretary's interests that are at stake here, Your Honor. As this Court articulated again rather emphatically in Bove, the issue in question here is the Court's prejudice. Would situations such as these, allowing for equitable tolling, somehow manage to invite additional fiscal responsibility on the court, depleting its already scarce resources. The secretary, again, simply doesn't have any interest in barring appellant's access to the courthouse. If the court renders these facts or just determines these facts to be extraordinary, then the secretary will quite happily proceed to addressing the merits. So
if the court changes its mind, you're content with that?
Yes, Your Honor. We
what about, should this even be an adversary proceeding?
Without doubt, it should be, Your Honor.
Why?
Well,
what interest does the secretary have in preventing a veteran from proceeding on the basis of equitable tolling?
Well,
he comes with his facts. We make a decision. It's exclusively ours to make. We either apply past standards or decide on a case-by-case basis.
Well, I'm not quite sure what the...
Why would you argue again? Why do we need an adversary proceeding for that?
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you mentioned appeals to this court.
No, of course. But we're talking about an equitable tolling situation.
Yes.
The right to even bring his case here.
Right.
Why does that have to be adversary?
It arguably isn't. We're simply here to elucidate our view of what the evidence requires.
You're telling us you either don't believe the doctor or you don't believe he should get the benefit of equitable tolling because he could have, and in response to the chief judge's interrogation, he did this, he did that, he did this. Why couldn't he have come forward sooner with his appeal to this court? I mean, aren't you putting a gloss on these facts? Adverse to the veteran?
No, Your Honor, and in fact, that question, I think, unduly shifts the burden to the secretary, where this court and the Federal Circuit have repeatedly stated that it is not only a very high standard that must be shown, but it must be shown by the person seeking the benefit.
I happen to agree, but I don't agree with that we're precluded from changing the standard.
Well, the Federal Circuit standard governs.
Persuading them to change their standard.
Right, but that would be for another day.
It's
right.
Actually a very interesting issue because after the Supreme Court declared that it was a rule, a very important rule,
right.
It truly put it within this court's purview as to how we were going to proceed. So Judge Greenberg, I think, is correct. Although we have case law now that establishes the standard and puts the burden directly on the appellant, and I guess we could change it too.
Arguably, Your Honor, that is the case. But the one point that the Secretary does embrace and wants to emphasize is the very title of the doctrine really informs the jurist. This is an extraordinary threshold one must meet. In order to relax the standards, whether incrementally or wholesale, would be really to undermine the sanctity of that form of equitable relief for people truly deserving of it in the court's view.
I'd like to just get back to something you said early on about the stay concept. You said we can only stay things over which we have jurisdiction. And I believe that language is contained in 522. But when I look at the language of 524, it just says, if a service member is materially affected in complying with a court judgment or order, can stay the execution of any judgment. Its applicability applies to an action or proceeding commenced in a court against a service member before, during, after the period of service member's military service or within 90 days. 524 doesn't speak of limiting it to actions over which that body has jurisdiction.
Because
so that modifies your judgment.
Because 525 rules 524. I mean, it's expressly accepted from the application of 525, which is unfortunately a point that the Secretary misread in briefing. But in order to invoke 524, one must seek a stay and be a service member or within 90 days thereafter. Those facts did not obtain here, as a result of which 524 is simply unavailing.
524 doesn't require them to seek a stay.
No, 522 does. And 522 applies to...
But you don't need 522.
Except 522 applies to actions under this...
524 stands alone.
Court's indulgence for one second.
The way I read 522 is that it stands for broader actions than 524 can.
Well,
perhaps it
that would read
broader, but 524 stands alone. 525, which tells you how the duration is, actually says it doesn't even apply to 522.
Well, but that inclusion itself under the canons of construction really kind of implies that 522 applies to all of the other provisions. Now, 591 is inapplicable here because that's anticipatory relief, and we're not dealing with that issue. But 525's exception of 522's application is informative as to whether it applies to 521, 522, or rather 523 and 524.
I think just says 525 doesn't apply to 522 because that's where you already are present in the proceeding, but you're still left with 524 as a standalone.
But it still requires he be a service member, and it requires that he request one, a stay, that is.
It says court may on its own motion.
May, and that would be the board, not this court, because of when the stay would have had to have been effectuated. It would have been prior to the board's decision.
Stay the execution of any judgment or order entered against a service member. And if you view this as a board order saying you must accept my decision or appeal, it seems to me it's a board order that provides a time period in which they must do something or accept their decision, and I think we could exercise jurisdiction over it.
An execution or a judgment requires an affirmative act be taken by a tribunal. Here, the exhaustion or extinction of the 120-day appellate period is by operation of statute and is more akin to an issue of mandate as opposed to judgment. That being the case, in the absence of having acted in that time, and I see that mine is almost up, the appellant simply, in the Secretary's view, is not entitled to any such stay, nor has he demonstrated, we believe, any extraordinary circumstances that directly interfered with his ability to file his notice of appeal in a timely fashion. And as a result of the Secretary's concession that Section 526 applies, the due process Mullane argument becomes legally moot.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Your Honor, may I have a moment to confer with counsel?
Sure, go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honors.
You have 10 minutes.
Thank you. I would like to make 3 points on rebuttal. First of all, Your Honors, it is uncontested here that Colonel Osmond was, A, disabled at the time he was deployed, that he was deployed to Afghanistan, that the opinion was issued to a home address while he was deployed, and that the only psychological evidence in this case points to a conclusion that Colonel Osmond was incapable of responding within the 120-day deadline. Second of all, Your Honor, as the Secretary correctly agrees with us and points out, Section 526 applies in this case and provides mandatory and minimum level of tolling applicable to all veterans on active duty. Although 524 and 525 are difficult to literally apply in this case, for over 100 years, the Supreme Court in both Conroy v. Aniskoff and Boone v. Leitner has interpreted SCRA liberally, and has directed, at the very least, that this Court should take notice of Congress's intent to provide additional tolling and stays to veterans who suffer material hardships while on active duty. Finally, Your Honor.
526, I know you said that the opposing counsel agrees with you, but it's titled a statute of limitations, and the time to file in our court is not a statute of limitations.
That's correct, Your Honor, but also in the definition section of SCRA, I think the language is clear that Section 526 applies to a number of civil proceedings far beyond what the court may simply think about as statute of limitations.
Yeah, and again, have any courts interpreted it that way, the broad language, and accepted that over the title?
Again, Your Honor, this has not been decided specifically in the case of cases before the CAVC. However, again, in Conroy v. Aniskoff and in Boone v. Leitner, the Supreme Court has decided that SCRA should be interpreted liberally. And again, in Conroy v. Aniskoff, the Supreme Court actually interpreted Section 526 as both a mandatory and minimum tolling deadline.
Well, actually, the Supreme Court in Conroy was interpreting 525, which became 526. I mean, the language didn't change, did it?
That's correct.
And the court held, excuse me again, the statutory command in 525 is unambiguous, unequivocal, and unlimited. Do you agree with Justice Stevens? And more importantly, do you agree with the dissent or the concurrence of Justice Scalia? Stop there. We don't need to go into any legislative history.
Well, Your Honor, I fully agree certainly with the main opinion. As far as the concurrence, I think Justice Scalia is completely correct that there's no need to read any other limitations into Section 526. Whether or not it's appropriate to read Section 526 as a limit of tolling, because there's simply no language providing further tolling in 526, I think that may be inappropriate under the other statute or the other provisions of SCRAW, and certainly under the intent that Congress has provided.
Well, and also that language is intended to apply to boards and commissions and non-judicial bodies, and generally their deadlines for application or appeal would not be statutes of limitation. Is that correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Lastly, Your Honor, although this Court has, I think, correctly focused on the Barrett standard, noting that we do meet that standard in this case, and again, the only uncontested evidence, the only professional expert psychological opinion here has assessed that Colonel Osmer was incapable of filing in the 120-day deadline.
I don't think the Court has noted that.
Yeah, again, Your Honor, I'm not suggesting.
We may note that, but we haven't noted it.
Your Honor, of course, I'm not suggesting you have come to a conclusion at the moment, but I believe the Court has correctly focused on that question. More appropriately, I think, in the case of Colonel Osmer and in the case of veterans as a whole returning from service, the McCreary standard for extraordinary circumstances, which acknowledges the cumulative circumstances surrounding a deployment, disabilities, readjustment difficulties, et cetera, is more appropriate in this case and in cases like
that. I'd like to ask you a question about your McCreary argument. You seem to focus a lot on the time that he was in service, the fact that he was in combat. But if we accept that the Section 526 of the SCRA applies and we toll the 120 days to doesn't even start until he leaves service, then don't we only need to look at the circumstances that are happening from day one post-service? So in theory, we don't care about him being in combat or these other factors?
Yes, Your Honor. In theory, the circumstances suffered actually during the deployment are irrelevant for this Court's McCreary assessment. However, in terms of a psychological assessment and in terms of the reality of the difficulties of those of that deployment and how they perhaps bled over into a post-service period, which I think SCRAW again recognizes in 524 and 525, they may be relevant. And certainly a psychologist's assessment of those difficulties and how they persisted beyond service is quite relevant. Again, Your Honor, since McCreary, again, is the appropriate standard, this Court should assess whether or not a reasonably diligent appellant under the circumstances would have filed within 120 days of returning home.
Getting to the reasonably diligent part, should we look at a reasonably diligent person, a reasonably diligent combat veteran, a reasonably diligent veteran of any kind would have filed? Can you help us on that?
Yes, Your Honor. Absolutely a reasonably diligent combat veteran, and more importantly, a reasonably diligent veteran in Colonel Osmer's or in that veteran's specific circumstances. In this case, Colonel Osmer is, in fact, a combat veteran of three different deployments. He was, again, rated as 60% disabled by the VA in 2007. I'm sorry.
So he's looking at his mail, right, intermittently when he came back?
I'm not sure what his
exact. Well, then your doctor said he did.
Then I believe he did, Your Honor.
All right. So he's looking intermittently at his mail. And then in December, he finds the DAV letter. The board decision, we don't know what happened to it. Finds a DAV letter. How, all of a sudden, he no longer has PTSD? I mean, isn't this a happenstance? What if he had opened that mail in September? He would have been able to file and proceed?
Well, Your Honor, given that Colonel Osmer has demonstrated his diligence both before his deployment, informing the VA of his deployment, and after his deployment in responding
immediately. Why isn't your opposing counsel correct? We have a lot of evidence that indicates that the veteran thought he could not appeal. He didn't. He says he didn't get his appellate rights. And then he came home and he was advised not to do much when you come back in life. But in fact, he is driving. And in fact, he is opening some mail. And in fact, by happenstance, he opens DAV in December. It wasn't like he all of a sudden said, oh, I feel better, I'm going to open up the DAV one. It was, I opened up the DAV one, and then all of a sudden he feels better, according to your doctor. And I'm just curious, how does that happenstance turn into this?
Well, Your Honor, I think the difficulty here is that the actions happen in reverse. That is, Colonel Osmer got better and then opened his mail, not vice versa. And he was
able to
open his mail.
Where do you have anything to support that? I mean, even the doctor's statement doesn't support that.
Well, the doctor's statement, again, Your Honor, is the only expert psychological opinion I would not second-guess.
But he says in December, unless I'm misreading, and he says in December when he opened this letter, that's when he got better.
That's correct, Your Honor. Again, but the reason he was able to go through his mail and the reason he was able to address this and probably other difficulties associated with his readjustment was the fact that he was getting better, not the other way around.
Wouldn't this be better if we didn't have these nice little compartments in which every veteran, such as your client, feels obligated to place himself with such things as letters from doctors or psychologists? Why not adopt a rule, a broad rule or a holding in this case, that in order for us to apply the doctrine of equitable tolling, all we need is the veteran to come forward alone in a non-adversarial proceeding and we make a determination, or let the Secretary contest it if, as an adversary, they have a basis for it?
I think that could be quite appropriate, Your Honor, especially considering that, one, the Supreme Court has ruled in Henderson that this deadline is not jurisdictional, and two, that the Federal Circuit has recently stated in Tyrus that a veteran is entitled to equitable tolling upon simply showing
a good time student. Period? I mean, our case law is pretty stringent about somebody who gets mail and what they have to prove to demonstrate they didn't get it, isn't it? We could just eliminate that, too, and just say veteran comes forward and says, I'd like to appeal.
Right.
What's wrong with that?
What's wrong with that?
Well, Your Honor,
don't be afraid to answer. You never know what we're thinking up here.
I hope
we don't know what we're thinking up here.
He speaks for himself.
I'm speaking for myself. But you never know which one of us is going to persuade the others.
Yes, Your Honor, and seeing
so
that my time
just go full speed ahead.
I'm doing my best, Your Honor. Seeing that my time is coming to a close, I think this actually wraps perfectly into a conclusion, which is that, and I wholeheartedly believe is appropriate in this case, and perhaps in other cases, this Court's time is best spent hearing this case on the merits. This Court should find that this appeal was timely, both because he suffered extraordinary circumstances upon his return home, and B, he did not receive effective notice according to this Court's due process and Section 7104 standards. And again, Your Honor, we ask that
thank you very much
on the merits. Thank you.
This case will be submitted. We will come and greet counsel.
All right.
Thank you. This court is in recess.